I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that is already storing up sizable rations of sunscreen. Because, believe it or not, summer is coming. And along with it, the obligatory summer blockbuster movie season. We're going to be talking about two films already available to see that reflect the kind of energetic escapist fare that embodies typical summer offerings. First up is the sci-fi themed family adventure Everything Everywhere All at Once, followed by Kenneth Branagh's adaptation of the Agatha Christie mystery Death on the Nile. Let's begin this week's show by heading into what is known as a multiverse. In his 1969 novel Slaughterhouse-Five, Kurt Vonnegut wrote about a character who was unstuck in time. That could also describe Evelyn Wang, the character played by Michelle Yao in Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, written and directed by the filmmakers known collectively as the Daniels, Dan Kwan and Daniel Scheinert. Evelyn and her husband Wayman, played by Ki-Hui Kwan, own and operate a laundromat. They're struggling in a number of ways, though, both as a couple and Evelyn with her daughter Joy, played by Stephanie Hsu, but also in business. One major plotline has the Wangs meeting with an irritable Internal Revenue Service officer, played by an almost unrecognizable Jamie Lee Curtis. It's in the middle of the meeting that Evelyn is visited by a version of Wayman from another universe, telling her that she is experiencing only one version of herself, with countless others living out different fates. It is she, though, who holds the future of all the universes in her hands. Though this is a classic, if manic, science fiction setup, the heart of Everything Everywhere All at Once is a touching study of family dysfunction and a primer on how to fix relationships that seem beyond repair.
Well, there's a lot of movie here, and there's a lot to like about it, I think. We don't normally talk about this. I mean, I probably bring it up more than anybody, but hype that surrounds movies when they come out. I try not to be affected by it, but sometimes it's impossible.
Yeah.
And I can't recall a movie in recent memory that has been hyped up the way that Everything Everywhere All at Once has been for the last month. I think it premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and it's been getting rave reviews, people talking about how it's an automatic, one of the greatest films of all time,
and
crying.
Fascinating.
Yes, and people saying they just wept through the whole movie. So I went in maybe a little bit skeptical, and I didn't have the emotional response to this movie that a lot of people seem to be having. And that's okay. But I think that we see so much homogeny on a weekly basis, and so many filmmakers being given the reins to all kinds of properties and really not thinking outside the box when they're making their films. And the Daniels here are, to say they're swinging for the fences is an understatement, because they're trying every possible trick in the book. And there was a point during this movie, maybe like halfway through, where it did grow perhaps a little monotonous for me. That might sound counterintuitive because the movie is so random and there's new stuff happening all the time. Maybe it exhausted me a bit, but I think the opening stretch of this movie, the first 15-20 minutes where it's introducing us to these characters and sort of the world of disappointment and drudgery that they occupy, I thought, oddly enough, were maybe the most thrilling scenes in the movie. And then I think it ties together all of these disparate plot lines really well and in a satisfying way at the very end. In the middle, I thought maybe it could have used a little tightening, although I don't know how you explore or endless multiverses without becoming a little sprawling and unwieldy yourself. It's sort of the nature of the beast here. I really like seeing Michelle Yao. There are so many different versions of her in this movie, and she pulls them all off. At one point, it seems like one of the multiverse versions of Evelyn is Michelle Yao herself. She's like a martial arts movie
that's
star.
That's the one that MP wanted to be. Yeah.
And well, in that plot line, it looks just like a Wong Kar-wai movie, and there are parts
in the mood for love.
Exactly, and there are parts that look just like The Matrix, you know, just the idea of the person being
much
stuck
less
in
Ratatouille.
Yes, Ratatouille. Of course, we don't want to spoil too many of the jokes in Everything Everywhere All at Once. But yeah, I would like to see this a second time because I'm sure there are things that pass me right by.
Oh, you
I
think?
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to catch everything here. But I did like a lot of what I saw. I just wasn't as bowled over as a lot of people. And I think that's just – I think that's a me problem. And I think it was me maybe reading too much about this movie before going in because there's no way it could have met the expectations I had. So maybe I'm holding it to an unfair standard. But I did really like this, and I think it's a big step up from the Daniels' first feature, which was Swiss Army Man, which I didn't – which, I mean, I've never forgotten it.
Quirky.
To be fair, but it was not one of my favorites. So, yeah, really curious to see what they're going to do next because do they have any ideas left in their arsenal at this point? It seems like they threw everything at the wall for this
one. But isn't this like a sophomoric – effort, and sometimes they totally miss, and sometimes they hit.
Maybe we'll never have a chance to get this kind of budget again, so let's do everything we possibly can right now.
Nathan, I agree with you totally. There was so much to like about this movie because at its core, it really is about family, most important, about this relationship between a mother and her daughter, but also the relationship, the multi-generational part of it with her father.
You know, and how that affects her marriage.
Correct.
And her, with her
and
her relationship
it's
with
an
her
immigrant
husband.
Story.
Right.
It's all wrapped up in that.
Right, right. I told Dan I thought it was like the greatest menopause movie ever made. I'm not sure anyone else would agree with that. I agree with you also that I thought it could have been cut because there was not a lag, but it was sort of like there was a little bit too much showiness at one point that I thought could have been eliminated involving the daughter playing different personas and so forth. And I liked that, but I don't think it really enhanced the movie in any significant way. Mm. But Michelle Yeoh is a treasure. I mean, she was so amazing. If you, for no other reason, even if you're not into the multiverse or you're not into, you know, shifts in time or sci-fi or however, fighting movies, whatever, however you want to characterize this film, just to go to watch her is amazing. And the other supporting actors were equally good. Her husband, Waymond, who's played by
Ki Hui Kwan.
Right. I mean, he was great. I thought the daughter, played by Stephanie Hsu, was great. And the visuals were amazing at different points. And I love the homage to these different films of the past. I should be the target audience, and I'm not the target audience at all. So, yeah, I think it's gotten like a 98% positive critics rating
and
on
Letterboxd,
Rotten Tomatoes.
Letterboxd, which is this kind of social media film diary site, it is the highest rated film of all time on there. And that almost is like a disservice to the movie.
Right,
right, exactly. We have to be really careful. And, you know, I agree with both of you. I think that Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think for the first half hour at least, I sat there in the audience with a big smile on my face because I just loved everything that was going on. And my problem wasn't the scenes with the daughter, the sequences involving her. Mine was that, you know, there were a couple of those fight scenes that just went on way too long. It was like they were really in love with what they were doing. And a little bit of it was really good, and particularly with Ki Hui Kwan, some of his that either he was doing or the stunt double who looks like him was doing were really pretty good. They reminded me of the best of Jackie Chan or whatever. But they just went on too long.
It's good to see him again, too, because I think
he was a child star, right?
Yes.
I mean, he's in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
But
he's
Goonies,
one of the Goonies.
The Goonies
he's
yes.
Data in the Goonies. Yeah. And I believe after this, he kind of started working behind the scenes. And he might have been involved in stunt choreography. I want to say I read that at some point. So it's possible it was him. There's a fight scene near the very beginning that involves a fanny pack being used as a weapon. That did remind me of something out of a Jackie Chan or maybe even a John Woo movie. And that's high praise.
It is, absolutely.
And the Daniels, of course, come from music videos. And you can absolutely tell. I think even if you didn't know they came from music videos, you might be able to pick up on it. I thought that they made a really good choice in anchoring this story, which it ping-pongs and pinballs in all kinds of different directions, sometimes literally.
And sometimes X-rated. There were some that were really uncomfortable.
There's stuff like out of a Jackass movie, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought that they made a really smart choice in anchoring the story to a single location, which is this IRS building. And and you move around the building, like the atrium, the top floors, the conference rooms. So there is kind of a sense of, even though it is casting off in all of these different directions, there's some sense of control there. There's an actual center to this movie. And I thought that went a long way in grounding it and keeping us with those characters so that there was sort of a through line through all of this manic craziness.
Yeah. Well, and we didn't talk about James Hong, who plays her dad.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, you always love to see him show up. There were a couple of sequences or a couple of plot points. I'm just going to say the word hot dog fingers that didn't quite work for me. I'm not sure what was up with that.
Very goofy.
Yeah, but I think those are fun things that, you know, can enhance a movie going experience.
Without spoiling anything, my favorite part were the rocks with googly eyes.
I agree.
The
little commentary.
Yes, I thought that was actually, and it's one of the rare moments of quiet in a film that is very boisterous
action-packed.
And very loud. And I thought that it was kind of a nice respite, a nice a way to kind of catch your breath as it kept going.
The thing I want to say is I think that this is a film, we talk about this every once in a while. We're going to be talking about a film in the second half, Death in the Nile, which you can totally see on your television set. But Everything Everywhere All at Once, you need to see this on the big screen. And you probably will going to need to see it twice if you've got the stomach for it. Because as you talked about, Nathan, there is so much going on. How could any of us pick up all of it? It is just way, way, way too much. At any rate, that was Everything Everywhere All at Once. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Death on the Nile. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
What's going on?
Look. Up ahead.
What's that? Up ahead.
Look up ahead there.
You guys, look. There's something up ahead.
What do you see?
What do you see?
What do you see?
What do you see?
As we look ahead to the future, there's much we don't know.
So true. So true.
So true.
That is the truth.
One thing we do know is that SPR's mission to create a more informed public is as vital as ever. The more you listen to SPR and NPR, the more you hear the world as it really is. We aim to bring more facts, more experts, more of the perspectives that make your world a vibrant place. Thank you for choosing us as your trusted place for news and music programming. We also want to thank those who donated to the station now and through the years. You are a critical part of what will make our work possible. Your generosity and commitment energize us. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Let's now move to Death on the Nile, which is now streaming on Hulu and HBO Max. Most novels written in the first half of the 20th century don't play well these several decades later, when a far more accepting attitude toward race and gender politics is not just welcomed, but expected. Case in point, Agatha Christie's 1937 novel, Death on the Nile. It's natural, then, that director Kenneth Branagh, fresh off his Oscar screenplay win for Belfast, would rely on an update of Christie's work, delivered by screenwriter Michael Green. The basic story is the same. A newly married couple, played by Gal Gadot and Armie Hammer, goes on a Nile River cruise, only to experience a series of threats and then, of course, deaths. Fortunately, one of Christie's greatest creations, the Belgian detective Hercule Poirot, played by Branagh himself, is on hand to solve the case. While the conclusions should be obvious to anyone who is paying attention, and the acting is chancy, Gadot in particular may not be quite ready for Shakespeare, if you know what I mean. The film, long past its theatrical run and now available for home viewing, is a pleasant enough entertainment. And especially so with the inclusion of Letitia Wright and Sophie Okonedo, who add a bit of diversity to the whole exercise, something that would never have occurred to Christie, or to be fair, any other writer of her generation.
Gee, this is a tough one to talk about Death on the Nile. You know, it's traditional in many ways, and I think that's the struggle here, and you sort of allude to that, Dan, in your introduction, because this is something that was written almost a century ago now, and so the question is, do you update it and make it more modern, a la Knives Out, for example, or do you stay with the traditional story? And I think this movie, in some ways, tries to have it both ways. And I think that that might be its primary failing, ultimately. You know, it has these beautiful scenes, a lot of
CGI.
Yeah, CGI, which is good and bad. The acting.
All over the place.
Yeah, gee, that's a tough one. I think that I love Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, but that might have been her wondrous, wonderful performance. I'm still waiting to see what happens in the future because she has to carry this movie in some respects, and I'm not sure that she's just quite up to that task. So you really have to look to the supporting cast. The other thing that's a little creepy is, you know, Armie Hammer is the romantic lead. And knowing what we know about him in real life, sometimes it's hard for me to put those things aside and, you know, suspend my disbelief about who he's supposed to be in this film and so forth. But, you know, it has the usual plot points that we appreciate from Agatha Christie. It's this beautiful Nile cruise that I was hoping maybe we could take someday, just putting it out there.
Just hopefully there are no murders on your cruise when
right.
you do go.
Well, you know me. I love the murder
That's
show.
That's true.
So
probably
I would
dig
be,
it.
Yeah, I'd be down with that for sure. But I really do think that Sophie Okonedo, who plays the jazz singer, I loved watching her. And I also, of course, love Jennifer Sanders.
French
from
and
Absolutely
right.
Fab.
Yeah, and
fabulous.
Don French is in there too. Right.
Right. And so I liked those additional characters. But
and let's face it, Branham was good. Branham makes
sure.
a good Hercule
yeah.
Poirot. I don't know that the character as he sees him fits what Christie did. I mean, you know, but still, at least he has a decent French accent, which Annette Bening, where was her accent? She was supposed to be British?
I think Death on the Nile is maybe the most okay movie ever made. It is whatever. It's not that bad. It's also not very good. I couldn't pinpoint why it isn't great. It just isn't. I don't know. This movie just kind of exists. It's a fact. I don't even know if I have an opinion about it. But I guess I'll say that I've seen the original Death on the Nile film, the one from 1978,
right.
which had Peter Ustinov as Poirot, Betty Davis, Angela Lansbury,
yeah.
Maggie Smith, great cast. And it's funny because as I
Ingrid Bergman, right?
No, that's the Murder on the Orient Express movie.
Yes,
which I think is probably the best of all the these ones we're talking about. And of course, Branagh himself remade or did another version of Murder on the Orient Express just a few years ago. That movie was also just okay. I started watching this movie and I thought, you know what? I don't remember how the actual story plays out. And I'm aware that the Agatha Christie estate doesn't really allow filmmakers to take dramatic license with her stories. You kind of have to stick to the
original thing. He did. I mean,
well, I'm talking about like the outcome of the mystery.
Oh, right, exactly.
You can probably mess around with details here and there, but the whodunit, you got to stick to.
Yes.
And so I realized I didn't remember. And then by about the halfway point, I was like, oh, that's right. It was that person. And,
and
that was why. And it was like, okay, yeah.
What was Russell Brand doing in this movie?
No
exactly.
idea.
I mean, he was fine, but it's like, that's sort of random.
If you're going to cast Russell Brand, let him be Russell Brand.
So maybe that's the problem, is that the nature of the whodunit, specifically as Agatha Christie kind of perfected it, requires a big sprawling cast because you have to, and they all have to,
suspects.
You know, they all have to be suspects, and most of them are going to be red herrings, which means that by the end of the story, you realize like, oh, none of these people really mattered to any of this at all. They're
right.
just there to either distract from who actually did it or to give us some kind of flavor
right.
or quirks. And none of these characters really have any memorable quirks or any real flavor. It's just kind of a flavorless movie. I will agree with you that Branagh is a good Poirot, but we were talking about this before the show. I just wonder what happened to him as a director, because I think back to some of his earliest films, the actual Shakespeare adaptations
right.
that he did in the 80s and 90s, and they had a grit and a style and an eccentricity to them, and he's just – all of the edges have been sanded off. And I know I'm in the minority in thinking that Belfast was an absolute snooze and had no personality whatsoever. I know you guys weren't that crazy about it either, but I just I miss the Branagh that was, and I actually stopped this movie at one point and went to look at his To Be or Not to Be speech from the Hamlet film adaptation he did, which
Henry
was
V.
so exciting. Like,
well, how about Henry V?
Well, and that too.
Yeah.
So I my mind was just wandering through this whole thing, through Death on the
Nile. I wanted to say one thing about Gal Gadot. I just love looking at her. She's great on the screen, and I have not read the novel, so I don't know what Christie had in mind, but I think she was miscast because you have to have some sort of question about her character and what happens in the storyline. And it's like, you'd just be entranced with this woman in real life if we're supposed to believe the story. So what happens in the film just didn't strike me as believable at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that threw me completely.
It's a mystery. It's supposed to be fun, I think. But it has these sort of overarching themes that deal with, you know, class and, you know, so how do you deal with the racial tension in a film such as this? I don't know. And I think that's part of...
There was no racial tension, was
right,
there?
Right, and that's
part of the one part about the one guy saying a brown man carrying a gun, the Egyptian people will just shoot me. That's the only really mention of race in the entire film.
Right. And so I think that that's also how do you make it resonate for 21st century audiences? And I don't know how familiar young people are with Agatha Christie in any way.
I mean,
my grandmother read those books in the 1960s. And so I don't know if people are still reading today.
I do think the format of the story is a timeless one. There's a reason that her work is, you know,
still in print.
You know, billions of copies have sold, and The Mousetrap and Then There Were None have been ripped off a million times. I mean, every slasher movie is basically an Agatha Christie story, and it's And Then There Were None. I want to say, though, to give Branagh some credit as a technician as opposed to credit to Branagh as a filmmaker, I thought that both this and the Murder on the Orient Express film used their set really well, because most of this movie is on a boat, because you have to trap the characters in one location so the murder can occur and nobody can escape. And I thought
a train.
Yeah, the way that he uses the camera in both of these movies, these long tracking shots down the deck of this beautiful boat, and the way that he had these long tracking shots down, you know, the cabins and the train, I thought that that was really good. So there is style in this movie, I suppose, but a lot of it does feel like really beautiful, glamorous movie stars cavorting in front of green screens.
Well,
to,
and maybe
to an
Viking river cruises will benefit from this, because I never wanted to take a river cruise, and now I'm like, maybe I could do this.
Yeah. We'll just don't take your little 22 pistol, okay? That's right. And that was Death on the Nile. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Murray Petruthart and I discussed Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the author Terry Pratchett. Of course, fantasy is escapist. Most stories are. So what? Teachers are not meant to be jailers. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.